We will open a public hearing for the purpose of taking testimony and open the House Rules Committee. And this first hearing is for... And I do want to make a comment just before I say it. I want to thank all of my Republican colleagues for being here.
You're welcome.
I did want to note that.
Let's vote on something.
So we're going to open a public hearing for the purpose of taking testimony on House Bill 2466. And it's on the Legislative Council Roll Review Reports. Oh, and now we have a quorum, actually. So with that, I will have our administrator give us a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. This measure requires administrative review reports to be considered by interim committees with subject matter jurisdiction over a state agency's area of responsibility rather than by the Legislative Council Committee. Requires the Legislative Council to develop a list of state agencies with areas of responsibility primarily within the subject matter jurisdiction of interim committees and to assign all state agencies to at least one interim committee for rule review. Under existing law, ORS 183.710-0.725, Legislative Council prepares administrative review reports at the direction of the Legislative Council Committee or upon written request from any member of the Legislative Assembly, and under some circumstances, at the request of people who are affected by a rule. Reports on by the Legislative Council are submitted to the Legislative Council Committee for consideration. That's my summary.
And with that, I will call Dexter Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. Let me just begin with a little bit of background. Since 1963, the Legislative Assembly has directed Legislative Council to review every rule that is adopted by state agencies. And those are approximately, I'm sure that it wasn't that way in 1963, but now it's approximately 1,500 rules a year. And for many years, the rules were reviewed by our office, and then for the 1 or 2% where we found that there was either a lack of statutory authority for the rule or some other constitutional problem, we would prepare a written report and present that to the Legislative Council Committee. The affected state agency would appear when the Legislative Council Committee met and present their side of it, and then the Council Committee would either adopt Legislative Council staff findings or perhaps modify those findings to take into account the agency position. The Legislative Council Committee over the past decade or so has met only very infrequently. And as a result of that, the situation that I inherited when I was appointed to Legislative Council was that there was a backlog of approximately 4,500 rules. And the Legislative Council Committee still only meets very infrequently. And what this bill does is to address that problem and get the rule review program going again by providing essentially that the those interim committees that have subject matter assignments that relate to the particular agencies who are adopting the rules, that will be the venue where Legislative Council will will present their rule reports. And that's the main change in this. The other change, the 4,500, the backlog of 4,500 rules, this bill will essentially wipe the slate clean and say that those rules or the agencies involved have complied with the statutes, and we're going to start anew with rules adopted as of January 1, 2009. This bill preserves or does not change what is in existing law, and that is that any member of the Legislative Assembly can request a rule review by Legislative Council staff at any time. And in fact, if we get a request, and this happens from time to time, from a particular member to look at a particular rule, we will actually look at that much more intensively than for these rule review reports, where we simply look at, is there statutory authority for the rule, and does the rule provide any create any other constitutional difficulty. So this bill does not change that. It does address this kind of growing problem with how to actually move forward with this program. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do I have any questions? I have a few. The first one would be, so the process would still be the same. You would do the legislative review. If there were any issues on any of them that came to mind, you would then go to an interim committee assigned to that particular issue. You would come and present to that interim committee, and the agency would be there to defend their point. They'd have that conversation, and that committee would be making the decision that you talked about that this legislative committee used to make.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And constitutionally, that's that is limited to simply adopting the Legislative Council staff report or modifying it or
right.
saying rejecting it.
And so the rule would actually be coming back to more than likely the same committee that had heard the issues that set up the policy that created the rule.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Yes, Representative.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, because the bill says that it just simply says will be assigned to the subject matter would be assigned to an interim committee and at least shall assign all state agencies to at least one interim committee. That sounds like it's assigned more by, here's the list of amended rules and here's the committees. Who makes the decision as to which committee it goes to if there's no prior history on that particular agency?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, the bill would direct the Legislative Council to develop a list of agencies and line that up with a list of interim committees. Agencies change from time to time. Certainly interim committees change a lot, and so basically, as soon as the interim committees are established, LC would assign particular agencies to a particular committee. If it's a large agency like DHS, for example, there would probably be, and the bill gets into this, DHS rules that could be assigned to a committee on the House side and another one on the Senate side, and the workload split as equally as possible.
One quick follow-up.
Yes.
So once an issue is assigned to an interim committee, it cannot be moved from that committee. That committee retains jurisdiction over that particular issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's true, but it's not based on issue. It's based on agency. And the reason for that is simply because of the volume of rules that we're talking about here.
Follow up
yep.
again. So just change my question to, once an interim committee has an agency, it's not going to be moved to a different interim committee during the interim. It can't be moved by you, your office, or... In other words, I'm addressing the jurisdictional question.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's the language here, if you look on the first page, lines 20 through 22, if there is, for example, a change in the subject matter that an interim committee used to be rules and elections and now it's just rules, something like that, if there's a change like that, the agencies would be adjusted accordingly. But it would have to be to modify, the list is modified to reflect changes in interim committees. So
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you break up sub-agencies within a larger agency, for instance, the Department of Human Services, which has enormous rural workload and would be more appropriately distributed between a number of committees? For instance, healthcare and human services are very different, yet that agency covers all of those things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, yes, I think given based on the anticipated volume of rules, that would be appropriate, but it would again be based on either agency or subdivision of agency and not on the substance of a particular rule, which to identify that in advance would create a workflow backlog, which is what we're trying to avoid here.
Can I follow up?
Not today.
May I follow up?
Yes, please.
So just to clarify, so Department of Human Services, for instance, healthcare wouldn't get an assignment that said you're responsible for everything coming out of the Department of Human Services. They might get DMAP and alcohol and drug, and then maybe Human Services would get seniors and people with disabilities. Those pieces you would break apart.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, by way of information, I was on the Legislative Council Committee that last heard a series of these. I think it was the last time they were heard. And this is not a massive workload issue because most of the rules are not in any way contested. It's only when Legislative Council says, wait a minute, this is a significant deviation that we want to bring it to the attention. And, I mean, for an interim committee, we heard all, not by subject area, but all, and our meetings were an hour.
Okay,
to give you a kind of scope of the work, I mean, I don't remember, they were really boring, but I don't remember them going on for hours and hours of hours. Excuse me, Mr. Counsel.
And okay. Obviously you were on that committee because you understood the breadth of the whole state.
Well, it was
all of them.
It was most interesting, I will tell you this, I'd love to make this comment on the record. I was a freshman. I was writing laws. It was fascinating to me to find out how the words that I was writing could be interpreted when somebody goes to make rules, completely different than what I thought I was reading. And that's the real value of this, because sometimes our laws aren't perhaps as clear as we think they are.
And a follow-up to that one is that that's one of the things that made this bill intriguing to me, is that all of us have had those situations where we find a rule has been drafted, and it probably was done legally within the authority and all that, wasn't a question, but it certainly was a lot different than what the intent was that we thought we had. And currently, it's just a few people would have ever seen any of that. This way, it spreads it out for all the committees and most of our members to have an opportunity to recognize that the job is not done when we pass the bill, that agencies have a lot to do after that, which includes this rulemaking. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Farrar.
What happens to the Legislative Council Committee? I don't think the bill says anything. Is it terminated, extinguished, goes bye-bye?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, well, let's hope not. No, the Legislative Council Committee continues, and all of its duties remain, including this rule review program is one which the Legislative Assembly merely authorizes, and the Legislative Council Committee could actually, as a committee decision, stop that. But the legislative leadership has concluded that they want the program to continue, but to have it work better. So the short answer, anyways, is the Legislative Council Committee remains, and it remains unchanged.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there, are there any other people? No one else has signed up to testify to this bill. Is there anyone else? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2466. And we will open... We're going to open a public hearing for the purpose of taking testimony on House Bill 2466. And with that, I will have a short explanation by our committee administrator. Did I do the right one? 2352, I'm sorry. Open that session at 2352. I didn't get to the back page.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. This measure requires the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to do three things: prepare and submit racial and ethnic impact statements to the legislative committee prior to hearing on legislation that may affect racial and ethnic composition of the criminal defender population; two, to develop a standardized protocol for preparation of racial and ethnic impact statements; and three, to prepare racial and ethnic impact statements on state ballot measures that may affect racial and ethnic composition of the criminal defender population. It establishes a process for the Secretary of State to hold hearings on statements and for statements or revised statements to be printed in voters' pamphlets and on the ballot. It requires the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to prepare and consider racial and ethnic impact statements in establishing rules applicable to parole and post-prison supervision. Oregon does not currently require the use of racial and or ethnic impact statements. Proponents assert that there are significant disparities in incarceration rates for ethnic and racial minorities. In 2008, Iowa became the first state to enact legislation requiring policymakers to prepare racial impact statements for proposed legislation that affects sentencing. Proponents assert that two other states, Connecticut and Wisconsin, have also taken action on this subject. A somewhat similar bill, HB 2933, was introduced in the 2007 legislative session by Representative Shields at the request of Jess Barton. No action was taken on that bill. And that's my summary.
Okay. Thank you. With that, Representative Shields.
Is it okay?
Jess, sure. Barton, yes. Jesse Barton as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland, District 43, here in the Oregon House of Representatives. And I'm very pleased to bring this bill forward to you that was brought to me by Jess Barton, an attorney in private practice here in Salem. And what this bill is about is making sure that there aren't unintended consequences to some of the legislation that we have. Now, when we consider sentencing laws and changes in sentencing law, we have a fiscal impact statement that primarily looks at what's the cost going to be to the judicial system, the criminal justice system, Department of Corrections, et cetera. What this bill would say is there should also be a racial impact statement. And why is that important? Well, if we are concerned about minority overrepresentation, and this bill sets aside, you know, the debate or argument about why that minority overrepresentation exists, to simply say, if we're concerned about it, what we should do is, when we go into considering a bill, have our eyes wide open. And if we find out that this particular approach is going to exacerbate minority overrepresentation, then at least we have that information. We can either tap on the brakes and say, you know, is there another way to get to the end goal of increasing public safety, or is this really the best option, and maybe we go ahead and make that decision and move forward with making that bill law. But again, it's important to have all the information so that we can go in with our eyes wide open. An example of this might be a bill related to enhanced penalties for gang members. Perhaps enhanced penalties for gang members might be the best way to go about attacking gang violence. But if we got the numbers back that said that this would exacerbate the minority overrepresentation, we could then say, well, maybe what we should do is invest in, say, a gang task force of law enforcement officials in East Multnomah County, an area that has concentration of gang violence. And I think that From what I understand, the district attorneys will be coming forward proposing an amendment. I think Jess has discussed that amendment with the district attorneys. I think we're fine with it as long as it doesn't, blow up the bill with a too big of a fiscal. And then I think that judiciary had some concerns about having a sentence or two taken out regarding the Supreme Court, and I think we would be fine with both of those amendments. But at this point, we figured we'd go forward, bring the bill to you, testify on it. And I think after I hand it off to Jess, we'll be dialing in to Mark Maurer with the Sentencing Project, who has an understanding of how these bills have been implemented nationwide.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Barton, yeah.
Would Mark Maurer be going first?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm here on behalf of an organization called Pacific Policy and Research Initiative. It's the research arm of a separate organization called Pacific Sentencing Initiative, LLC. The Pacific Sentencing is dedicated to two basic principles: that persons subject to criminal prosecution should be provided due process without capricious fact-finding, and that persons should incur the least restrictive sentencing alternatives consistent with the government's compelling interest in public safety. Before I go on, I appreciate the opportunity to present my testimony to this committee today. I actually have a PowerPoint presentation I wanted to give just to establish, I think in my mind, what the state of Oregon needs this particular bill. I also wanted to mention, though, that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association fully supports House Bill 2352. If I could just have a moment. I'm just going to start off really bluntly. That's a little better. But the racial disparity that I'm going to talk about the most has to do with the disparity between incarceration rates for Caucasian and African American Oregonians. That's the starkest disparity that we have in this state. This is based on 2000 census data and July 2000 Department of Corrections data. For each Caucasian Oregonian, the state imprisoned. It imprisoned 8 African-Americans. Actually, put it the other way, it's a more blunt way. An African-American Oregonian was 8 times more likely to be imprisoned than was a Caucasian Oregonian, which statistic that I throw out that people are often skeptical about. This is how I get that number. African-American Oregonians, there were in July 2000, there were just almost 1,100 in prison. And then the total African-American population in the state was just under 55,000. So about 2%, or 1 in 50 African-American Oregonians were living in prison. Look at this, by the way, these are numbers, the in-prison figure there that you see for Caucasian, 74-35, that's from the Department of Corrections. The total Caucasian population for the state was nearly 3 million, that's from the Census Bureau. So about 0.25% of Caucasian Oregonians were living in prison, so that's 1 out of 400. The percentage of African Americans in prison of 2% is 8 times greater than the percentage of Caucasian Oregonians. This is 0.25%. That's where I get the 8 times number. So one thing I was suggested to me was to compare data regarding other racial or ethnic minorities, and you don't see the same kind of stark disparities that you see with African Americans in this state. You see here that Native Americans, we had 247 in prison, just over 46,000 total of the state population. 0.5% were living in prison. That's double the rate for Caucasians, but it's only 1/4 the rate for African Americans. For Hispanics, it's actually a little bit better. We had 1,040 in prison, and then 285,000 almost was the total state population. So about 0.4% of the Hispanic population was living in prison. That's higher than the Caucasian rate of 0.25%. It's like 1.6 times higher than the Caucasian rate, but again, it's nowhere near the rate for African Americans. That's why I use this number, 8 times, an African-American was 8 times more likely to be living in prison than was a Caucasian Oregonian. If I were really good at PowerPoint, I'd have some kind of really cool-looking graphic display of just what that really means, and I'm not that good at PowerPoint. But all I can do is text. But if we take this hypothetical, if you were randomly select 10,000 Caucasian and 10,000 African Americans, have them sit in either end of Autzen Stadium in the end zones, and then ask those who came in from prison to please stand, what would happen is you'd have 25 Caucasians stand and 200 African Americans would stand. That's the best I can do in terms of a graphic representation, but it's pretty stunning. The 8x number that I talk about is a number way out of proportion to what could be explained in any other way than I think that is explained by the Supreme Court task force from back in 1994. This task force was chaired by former Chief Justice Edwin Peterson, who also was the primary author of the task force report. Conclusion 9 of the report, which is found at page 3 of this particular state report, says this, that in the criminal justice area, evidence suggests that compared to similarly situated minorities, minorities are more likely to be arrested, more likely to be charged, more likely to be convicted, less likely to get probation, and then the converse of that, more likely to be incarcerated. When you apply that to African Americans, I believe that is the predominant reason why we have this 8x disparity between Caucasians and African Americans in our prison system. Any criminal defense attorney such as myself who's practiced in an area where you have substantial sizes of African Americans can give you anecdotal examples of these sort of features that are discussed in the Supreme Court Task Force's report. My anecdotal one, it comes from a case I worked on when I practiced in Washington. It's this case called State versus Darren Barber. Darren Barber was African American. He was with two other African Americans in the city of Bellevue, Washington, one evening. They were walking down a city street, and I don't know if you're familiar with Bellevue, Washington, it has racial demographics about the same as Lake Oswego. But anyway, a police officer drives by and sees these three African American men walking along and becomes suspicious of them. And the question is why was he suspicious? And on the witness stand, the police officer says under oath, the reason he was suspicious was this, that if you see three black men walking together down the street in Bellevue, which is predominantly Caucasian town, normally that means a crime's just been committed. That was what he needed to know. And that was the basis for the starting point for his suspicion to conduct what's called an investigatory stop. This concept of these guys being out of place, being the wrong race for the town they were in, that's called racial incongruity. And it can work both ways. I mean, when I was doing legal research on the Barber case, I came across cases where white men had been stopped for being out of place because they were in an African-American town or African-American neighborhood of a town. So racial incongruity was the basis for this police officer's initial decision to investigate these three men. And the Supreme Court declared that as an invalid basis for conducting what's called an investigatory stop. Said racial incongruity should never constitute a finding of reasonable suspicion for criminal behavior. And what the Supreme Court did with that ruling was it basically did two things with respect to the executive branch of government and one with this respect to the judicial branch of government. What it did with respect to the executive branch was tell police agencies, you may not use racial incongruity as a basis for conducting investigatory stops. You just can't do that. Stop doing that if you're doing it. Don't do it anymore. So the Supreme Court kind of imposed an injunction on racial incongruity on police agencies. And at the same time, it imposed an injunction on lower courts by saying that if you are presented a criminal prosecution where evidence was obtained and through the course of some kind of search or stop or whatever that was based on racial incongruity, you may not admit that evidence into the court of law. The idea there is that the Supreme Court determines that it's better to keep out that evidence and let a prosecution go than to have a system of law where African Americans can be stopped for being in a white part of town or a white person can be stopped for being in a black part of town, that sort of thing. So what's We're getting to now, and this is actually something, this is a movement that that House Bill 2352 really is a part of, and there's this recognition that when you have states like Oregon, unfortunately, and other states as well, Oregon's not as bad as some states, but it's worse than most, in terms of having this eight times disparity between African American and Caucasian imprisonment rates. This idea now is that if there's going to be a continuing civil rights movement, it has to focus on the criminal justice system. That's where it goes. And so the fight, as one person said, instead of talking about where we sit on the bus, African Americans now have to talk about where they sit in the courtroom. And the idea is to reconstruct the criminal justice system in a way that over time could do away with these racial disparities. House Bill 2352 would be a tool in that. It's not the total solution by any means, and it's not retroactive or anything like that. It's not like House Bill 2352, if it became law, would require somebody to go back and look at all past laws that were enacted and determine if they produced racial disparities. That wouldn't be done. It would just be in the future. All new laws would be analyzed for racial and ethnic impacts. So this idea of reconstructing the criminal justice system is what some folks are calling the new reconstruction. This publication here refers to it as exactly that. There's an opportunity here and actually a need now to reconstruct the criminal justice system in a way that over time we could see a reduction in this, in these disparities and these racial and ethnic disparities that we see right now in our prison system. Excuse me. And that actually completes my PowerPoint show. I'm down to that last slide. But, of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? And then we have a phone conversation?
We're going to do that. Dialing it now.
Oh, he's dialing it now. Okay. We'll get it taken care of while we're doing it. Any questions? So you mentioned, and we mentioned in the testimony, the states that currently have this type of a bill. Iowa, which is somewhat similar to Oregon in its demographics.
Representative Shoffler's home state.
Oh, okay. what were the other states?
The other state, Mr. Chairman, is that I'm aware of is Connecticut.
Okay.
But I'll also understand that from talking with Mark Maurer, this will be appearing by telephone, that the state of Wisconsin has a system that's done by executive order in some fashion, and that Minnesota may also have some other type of system in place that's done through an executive branch agency, but not by legislative any form of legislative mandate.
Okay. Representative Gerard.
Thank you for your testimony today. I'm curious as to who does the racial and ethnic composition. Where do those numbers come from?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gerard, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right.
You are.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that.
Are you talking about the statistics I just showed that I just went through?
No, I'm not challenging those at all.
But
this is based on a composition of racial and ethnic. Where do the numbers come from? Is it a national? In other words, you're looking at Oregon's prison population, or are you looking at the nation's population when determining what that composition is,
right,
and you're basing a decision in Oregon on?
I believe that the composition ought to be based on, personally, that they should be based on Oregon statistics. There would be some good reasons for that. One would be, for example, just again going back to African Americans, the percentage, African Americans comprise about 1.6% of the Oregon population, but nationally the number is closer to 13%. So it really kind of wouldn't make sense if you're concerned with trying to determine whether there's going to be a racial disparity in Oregon that might result from some bill that's being considered. It wouldn't make sense to consider the national figure of 13% when the state figure is only 1.6%.
Yep. So the legislature could ask corrections, and they would have these numbers?
I don't know that corrections has, Mr. Chair, but Representative Gerard, I don't know the extent to which DOC has the sort of data that we would really want to have. I know that the DOC has data on their inmate profile in terms of race, but the DOC also has persons under its jurisdiction who are on probation. So they're under local control, but they're under the DOC's jurisdiction. And I had trouble at one point. I wanted to find out what the percentage breakdown of probationers were in terms of how many Caucasians were on probation as opposed to African Americans, and I couldn't find that data. So I don't know how thorough the DOC data are, but they could, if there's any, to the extent there's some limitations on those data, they could be improved. I mean, they should be able to acquire the data, and that's something that would have to be put in place over time. They could be, you know, putting in place a system to do these racial impact statements is going to take some time and resources.
Representative Shields wanted to answer that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McGrard, in the bill, the Criminal Justice Commission would be required to make that type of racial impact statement. They would lean on the Department of Corrections. But I think what will be interesting is that's a very good question for Mark Maurer, who was from the Sentencing Project, who has a much better sense of how these are working around the country.
Okay. Other questions right now? And we're on the phone.
Are we ready?
And this is?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go back to committee.
Okay. So. Are you there? Hello?
Hello?
Oh, there we go. I think we got it. Okay. This is the chairman of the Rules Committee in Oregon, and this is Mr. Maurer?
Yes, Mark Maurer.
Mike
Maurer. Project in Washington.
So it's your turn to give us your statement, and then we'll ask you some questions. And present, just so you know, we have three of our members of the committee, so go forward.
Okay, great. Well, first, thanks very much for inviting me to do this, and I wish I could do it again for some travel issues, of course. Let me just say a few words about our engagement with this concept of racial impact statements and just try to provide a quick overview of some of the movement on these policies in the country in the last couple of years. We've been very engaged with working with policymakers in promoting these concepts and essentially approach it from the point of view that it's very similar to a fiscal impact statement or environmental impact statement, which I think we've all come to recognize, you know, just represent good public policy. There are often unintended consequences of public policy, and we would be better off anticipating those in advance and trying to remedy any potential problems prior to enacting legislation rather than afterwards. The general concept of racial impact statement is essentially to permit discussion about potential unwarranted disparities in racial, ethnic impacts of criminal justice legislation. You know, as I understand it, if there are disparities that are analyzed that would be likely to occur, that in itself is not sufficient to say that the legislation should not be adopted. It's just one of a number of factors, with public safety and other things being part of that discussion. So it's an element of the discussion. There's been, in the last couple of years, quite a bit of movement around the country in moving forward on such policies. In 2008, two states, Iowa and Connecticut, became the first ones to formally adopt racial ethnic impact statements as part of their ongoing criminal justice legislation. In Iowa, it was virtually unanimous vote in both houses of the legislature. In Connecticut, there was strong bipartisan support as well. In both of those states, virtually as we speak, legislative staff are working out the mechanisms by which they can produce the impact statements when asked for by the relevant committee chairs, and how to do that analysis and what would be considered appropriate. Other states are doing similar things through different mechanisms. In Minnesota, a state with a sentencing guidelines commission, beginning last year, the commission took it upon itself to begin producing racial impact statements, and has already done that on a number of bills that have been introduced. These are generally just one-page analyses, very clearly laid out, provides the information to the legislature, and they've gotten positive feedback on having provided the information. In Wisconsin,
last year, the governor issued an executive order that would accomplish many of the same kinds of things. The executive order calls for all criminal justice agencies to track disparities in processing, to try to analyze those disparities, determine if they are warranted by legitimate public safety concerns or crime rates, to also develop programs and policies to try to address unwarranted disparities in particular, as they can do it in local systems. And finally, in Illinois last year, the legislature also voted to establish a commission to look at the issue of racial disparities statewide and to try to assess the extent of disparities, where they come from, any remedies that might be necessary to propose for that. I should guess that one other element of this, in Congress right now, through the bill introduced last year, the lead sponsor was Senator Biden at the time, legislation called the Justice Integrity Act, which is designed to look at federal prosecutorial policies and again to establish local task forces in selected U.S. attorney districts to engage in a similar process of data analysis, discussion about the issues, and the law. That bill is expected to be reintroduced this year. So there's been a good deal of activity. There's a good deal of momentum. As I indicated, this has been largely a bipartisan effort, and you know it's been designed, I think, as a way that policymakers and practitioners can have more information available to them as they're considering policies, so that we, as I mentioned, we can project or anticipate any unforeseen consequences prior to enactment and deal with them appropriately as they may come up. So maybe I should close there for the moment, and I would be pleased, of course, to respond to any questions or items that you'd like to pursue on that.
So, Representative Girard, would you like to ask that other question? We had a question that came up just before you came on that had to do with how do we go about using Oregon statistics and data to start doing this profile. I think we got the answer that we've kind of set up a commission. But what would they be looking at in trying to anticipate before the bill was enacted the kinds of issues? What were the kinds of issues that they looked at in trying to anticipate if it would have a undue influence on
how would you do that? Well, you know, it obviously will vary from state to state, and it partly depends on the quality and quantity of the data, and I don't pretend to be an expert on what that looks like in Oregon, but, you know, typically, you know, if the, let's assume for the moment that, you know, the penalty for burglary, you know, a second-time burglary is 2 to 4 years, and the legislature is considering raising that to 3 to 5 years. You know, in an ideal situation, if you have all the data, one would want to look at the racial ethnic breakdown of people convicted of a burglary offense, the same breakdown for people sentenced to prison for burglary offense. If possible, try to get data on time served in prison for burglaries and try to produce some sense of, you know, by increasing that sentence length, first, what would be the additional impact on the size of the prison population, and then of that additional number, you know, what would be the racial breakdown, the racial composition of that. As I said, I mean, there are ways, I think, if not all that data are available, you know, there are ways to get at least some of that. You know, it typically, I think in most states, there's often reasonably good data on the racial composition of people admitted to prison. So if nothing else, one could get a ballpark estimate of what that might look like. Of the people coming to prison for burglary, what does their racial composition look like, even if some of those other pieces of information might not exist in some states?
Okay. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? We don't have any other questions. Do you have any? We did have a couple of people who came on before and gave a fairly good explanation of where we are in our state. So,
okay, good.
I appreciate this answering some of the detailed kind of question about how we go about doing that.
Sure, sure. Well, I appreciate your interest in thinking about these policies as well.
Okay. Well, we thank you again then, and we'll sign off.
Okay. Okay. Thanks so much for having me.
Yep.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Georgette Brown, and we might as well bring Brenda Bays up at the same time. A couple of our regulars.
Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin and members. This is just...
One second. Can you hear in the back?
Oh.
Could you move the microphone closer to you? Because we found that out in the last time, and I forgot to move it up.
I'm Georgette Brown, and I'm representing the Oregon County Clerks Association.
Very good.
Okay. And I'm not for or against this bill, per se. And I just have a couple of comments on some of the wording in it. The general election ballots and even some primary election ballots are very full of measures, as you, I'm sure, have seen in the elections. And there is a statute in place, ORS 254-175, that provides that we only print on the ballot the 10-word caption or ballot title and the 20-word question. And then we have the full text of the measures printed separately on a measure flyer, and it's included with the ballot. And I'm sure you've seen those mm-hmm. also. So what we're asking is in this bill, in Section 3, lines 18 and 19, it states that the ethnic impact statement shall be printed in the voter's pamphlet and on the ballot. In light of what I'm saying, I would respectfully request that you just strike the words "and on the ballot" from this bill, and we could include the ethnic impact statement on the statement on the additional flyer that we send out with all the other state measures and impacts and fiscal statements.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? I think that was fairly clear. Yes.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the Secretary of State Elections Division. I'll be brief with my comments today, but wanted to discuss a few concerns with you. The bill provides that the Secretary shall print a racial and ethnic impact statement required by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission in the voter's pamphlet and on the ballot. This provision may increase the cost to the voter's pamphlet and the cost of printing ballots, depending on how many measures this would affect during a general election cycle. This could also increase the size of the ballot, making it possible that counties may have 17-inch ballots, as they did this past general election. Having larger ballots, as we have experienced before, may result in slower vote counts. To reduce these costs, our office would ask the committee to provide a word limit for these statements and to consider allowing the counties to include the statement, as Georgette Brown has just specified, with the ballots instead of printing it directly on the ballot. This would be similar to what counties may currently do now for the text and financial estimates of measures under ORS 254.175. Those are our concerns as well. If you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to address those.
Thank you. Questions? Nope. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Neely and Nancy Sellers. And again, talk close to the microphones because it works much better for the people in the back.
Go ahead. There you go. Are you sure?
Positive.
Okay. Thanks, Nancy. Good afternoon, committee. My name is Kevin Neely. I'm here on behalf of the state's district attorneys, and I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2352. The district attorneys in Oregon don't have any particular issues with this bill. As it's written, we think it only captures, unfortunately, a small part of the question that we really need answered here in Oregon. and that is, what's the impact of crime on these racial and ethnic groups? And so, as Representative Shields mentioned earlier, we've already spoken with Mr. Barton, we've already spoken with Representative Shields, and we would like to modify this slightly to include look at what the impact is on these racial and ethnic groups in terms of victimization. We know that, in fact, much of the crimes that occur in certain racial and ethnic groups tend to also show disrepresentation in terms of those racial and ethnic groups of victims. And so, again, to get a complete picture of what's happening as it relates to crime and certain racial and ethnic groups, we need to look at three things. One, what's the population of that community? What's the racial and ethnic population, the demographics of the community? What's the racial and ethnic impact on the criminal offenders? And finally, the third part, and we think one of the most important parts, is what's the racial and ethnic impact on the victims that are obviously a very important component in all of this, the criminal justice system. So again, the district attorneys, we haven't taken a position on this bill. I think that we may even find our way to supporting the bill if we can ensure that we have the complete picture of what's happening as it relates to crime and these racial and ethnic populations. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gelsner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kevin, I understand that you had an exchange with Representative Shields earlier today and did propose an amendment. If that amendment was incorporated into the bill, do you believe that the ODEA would come on board as a supporter of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelsner, I would have to go back and talk to the organization, but I do think that obviously any data that we have as we move forward in this process, as the voters review ballot initiatives, is good to have available. And as I said, I do think we could find our way, or I think there's a likelihood that we could find our way to supporting this bill if we had that full picture.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? No.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Nancy Sellers, Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. House Bill 2352 does mention the Board of Parole prominently in that it asks that we prepare and consider racial and ethnic impact statements in any rule change related to parole or probation. The board currently has on its books actively about 150 rules, and we do change them regularly, some based on law changes, but others based on practice. And we wanted to go on the record as saying we fully support the goals of racial and ethnic parity in the public safety system, and we would willingly consider racial and ethnic impact when amending our rules as part of our process. It's how we get to that point. It does require us in the statute in Section 4 to prepare and consider. So talking about some of the issues that Mr. Barton and I did get a chance to sit down and talk with him before coming in here, we don't have any research capability at the board ourselves. So getting those prepared and getting the data, we have the same issues as was mentioned for the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections computer information system and the parole board's information system are both legacy systems and in need of replacement. Some of you may have heard of movements to get us to a new system, but in this economic environment, it's not likely to happen for some time. So right now, we have difficulties even determining within the Department of Corrections population, demographically, who is under our parole release authority. We have our own records, but aggregating that data and using it in a meaningful way is a very large challenge for us. So as much as we are willing to work to make this happen, that is an issue, and also some specifics on the language of the bill. It refers the board to follow the same process as the Criminal Justice Commission follows, but that's dealing really with legislation, and ours are dealing with rule changes based on a population that has already been sent to us under statute and sentencing, where we have very little impact on the demographic makeup of the population under our release authority or under the conditions of supervision in the community. And actually, the sanctioning of offenders in the community is dictated by Department of Correction rule, not board rule. So we'd love to work with the committee and with the sponsors of the bill to help them with their intent, but because we do foresee a potential fiscal impact as an executive branch agency, we must remain neutral on any bill that isn't covered in the governor's recommended budget.
Thank you very much. Representative Garrard.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you see the application by the parole board in making your decisions? How would this report change your decision, your parole decisions?
That's one of the challenges we're having, because now we are looking at our rules, and I've done a review of them, and they are racially and ethnically neutral, and we are dealing with a population that was assigned to us by the courts. And so making a decision is based on the factual information before the board for a release hearing, and setting the conditions of supervision are universal for all offenders, regardless of racial, gender, ethnic minority, any other economic status. And so I'm not certain how that would work, and I do understand that different states have different parole and probation systems that have greater state control in some states. So I'd be willing to discuss those options, but haven't had the opportunity to do so yet.
Okay. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Everett L. Rich, Chair of the Commission on Black Affairs.
And welcome. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It is a pleasure and honor to be before you, and thank you for the privilege. I come before you as a citizen of
First,
Portland, Oregon.
Make sure you give your own name, because even though I did it. Yeah,
forgive
thanks.
Me. My name is Everett L. Rice, and I write in a very difficult way, so I know it's hard to read that. My name is Everett L. Rice. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm a 15-year member of the state of Oregon. I moved here from the state of Tennessee 15 years ago. I have the privilege of serving as the chair of the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs. We were very interested in this bill, House Bill 2352, because of our work for social justice throughout the state of Oregon. We have a prepared thoughts that we'd like to read into the record, but also I have some personal comments I'd like to enter at the end. But once again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, last week the commissioners of the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs voted in support of House Bill 2352. After discussion and presentations regarding this House bill, our commissioners fully support the concept of the bill. The state of Oregon has been a leader nationwide in many areas, from the first bottle bill to the Oregon Health Plan, and it has been on the cutting edge of recognizing diversity, the environment, and the rights of the individual and communities. And we ask, as a state-authorized commission, that this committee support and pass this bill on to the full House for full consideration. Oregon needs laws and administrative rules that take a close look at how legislation will fully impact the many diverse racial and ethnic communities we have here in the state of Oregon. Many well-intentioned laws and rules, unless evaluated and looked at ahead of time, can have devastating effects upon the communities of color throughout the state. Not everything that sounds or looks good at the moment will produce the desired effects that emotions and feelings of the moment or a politically charged atmosphere that we've come to expect. We respectfully ask that you, the members of the committee, support this bill and that you pass it for consideration by the full House. With great respect, the commissioners of the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs. On a personal note, I think I have a unique way of looking at this proposal in House Bill 2352. I served as a journalist for 18 years in the city of Little Rock, Arkansas, and the city of Memphis, Tennessee. And I also served with the state of Oregon and Department of Human Services for 11 years. I'm an independent businessman right now. But during those time periods, I saw the crack epidemic up close and personal as a journalist. I saw very stable neighborhoods change overnight during this epidemic. Many of the laws that were passed on a national and state basis to deal with that unfortunately had a negative effect on many of those communities that they were meant to protect. Laws having to do with prosecutions, extra years in jail for those who actually sold drugs within 1,000 feet of school systems. On the surface, a very good idea. But when you take the fact that in the state of Tennessee, especially, and in many areas, that most of your minority communities live within 1,000 feet of most school systems, especially in community of color communities, are usually one of the basis of the community. So many of the things that we thought would be good ideas on the surface led to an explosion of people of color within the judicial system and prison system. We're not asking for anyone to be let off from criminal activity. That is not the purpose of our supporting this bill. But we do want to have parity within the justice systems, and that the equality that this nation stands for, that equality also be carried out in sentencing and in convictions and in how we arrest people and how we deal with people within the justice system. So thank you very much. I'll be glad to entertain any questions if you do have any questions for me.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Gerard.
Mr. Rice, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Do you see this having a bigger impact on law enforcement than you do the judicial system or the executive part?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, I think it would have an effect on law enforcement, but I think it would have an effect in a positive way in that it would make law enforcement, and I come from a very strong family of law enforcement. One of the things I did, I was a reserve officer in Arkansas before I left there, and having worked on both sides of the issue, I think it would give law enforcement an opportunity to really think about some of the decisions that are made on a daily basis. We're all habits, we're all creatures of habit, so to speak, and the instance that Mr. Barden mentioned earlier about in Bellevue, Washington, where three African-American men were walking through a predominantly white neighborhood, it will give officers a better chance to reevaluate and to consider exactly their policing methods, and it will give us a chance to step back and to look at the overall community policing concept and how we as a nation really pursue justice as regards dealing with the public safety issue. And I'm sorry.
I hope
that answered your question.
Is there a strong association between this and profiling?
There is a. I see an invisible line between the two. Our commission is also working with the law enforcement's coordinating committee that is also working on racial profiling throughout the state. There is a very strong correlation, I feel, between the two. And I think it's just, as in anything, helping law enforcement and those who work in law enforcement see things from a different perspective many times will help solve the problem. But we would, once again, encourage your support for this bill with all the amendments that have been suggested that would make this bill better. No bill is perfect, but any amendments that can make this bill better, we would support that also.
Thank you for your response.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Other questions? Nope. Thank you very much for being here.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, excuse me, of the committee, begging of our commission here. But thank you for the privilege and appreciate all the work you do for all of us here in Oregon.
So that takes care of all the people who signed up. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify who did not sign up? I don't see anyone. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2352. I should remind the committee members that there will be no meeting of the committee this Friday, if that's okay with the two of you. Okay. But it looks right now that we will be having one on Friday, February 20th. There's a person that's a guest that's coming from out of state, and that was the only day that we could arrange that.
It's my week to stay here.
Okay, we're good. So with that, if there's no further business, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.